Welcome back to the UFO Rabbit Hole Podcast. I'm your host, Kelly Chase. The podcast is going to be on hiatus for a few more weeks as I work with the Ontocalypse team to wrap up production on our upcoming docuseries, The Beyond, UFOs and a New Reality, which is due out later this summer. But I didn't want to leave you guys hanging. So in the meantime, I've teamed up with J. Christopher King to bring you a series of unreleased talks from the phenomenal Inquiry into Anomalous Experience in the Phenomenon conferences. In the third episode of this series, we're bringing you a panel discussion from the April 2023 conference. This panel was hosted by Kurt Jaimungal of Theories of Everything and features Leslie Kane and James Fox. Listening back to this discussion is especially fascinating, given the timing. It was just a couple of months before the article written by Leslie Kane and Ralph Blumenthal broke in The Debrief, where the world learned about whistleblower David Grush and his allegations about the existence of top-secret UFO crash retrieval programs. So besides being a great conversation, it's an interesting time capsule of the period when this story was in development. One quick note about this episode. The questions from the audience were just a little bit hard to hear. So in the interest of clarity, you'll hear the questions read by Jay. Before we begin, I should mention that this episode is brought to you by the Experiencer Group. The Experiencer Group is a private online community dedicated to support, curiosity, and community for people who've had anomalous events of all kinds. They hold regular support meetings for people who are processing anomalous experiences, book clubs, special guest speaker presentations, and more. You can learn more and sign up at tegmembers.com. The link is in the episode description. So without further ado, here is Kurt Jaimungal.
Hi, welcome. Thank you. I appreciate that.
You deserve it.
All right. Just in case you don't know, my name's Kurt Jaimungal. I have a podcast called Theories of Everything, where we explore theoretical physics. That's my background, mainly mathematical physics. And we also explore consciousness. So what is the connection between consciousness and the fundamental laws, as well as recently artificial intelligence and the phenomenon. Leslie Kane is an investigative journalist. She's also the author of the New York Times bestseller, UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Go on the Record. She's also the writer of the award-winning Surviving Death, A Journalist Investigates Evidence for an Afterlife. Surviving Death is the basis of a six-part series on Netflix from around 2021. Leslie co-wrote a series of articles on UAPs for the New York Times beginning December 2017. And just a round of applause for that, because almost none of us would be here if not for that. Leslie has also helped produce the 2023 series, UFOs Investigating the Unknown, which is now streaming on Hulu. Director James Fox began his career early in life as an assistant to his father, writer Charles Fox. He has since completed and distributed TV projects for Discovery, for Sci-Fi, TLC, Nat Geo, formerly National Geographic, and History Channel. His films include Out of the Blue, I Know What I Saw, The Phenomenon. Round of applause for that man. And his latest release is Moments of Contact. The way this will work is I'll ask a couple questions. I have a profusion of questions. I have maybe 50 questions here, but I'll prioritize them somehow to about three. And then we'll just open it up to you all. And apparently there's a live audience who's watching, and we can get some questions for that. We only have about 40 minutes from now, I believe. So my first question is, it goes to both of you. What is it about your new film? So with Leslie, it's UFOs Investigating the Unknown. That's a series. And then Moment of Contact. What is it about your new film that you're able to do now for whatever reason? You can release it. What is it that you could say now because of it? What's new in it that you couldn't do prior? And we'll start with Leslie.
Okay. I was ready to go.
Sorry, Leslie.
I mean,
His film is a lot newer than my film, so that's why I wanted to give it to
him. Sure, sure, sure.
So the question was, what's new about it?
Yeah.
I mean, we did get some interviews with people that we had never had before on camera, like Helene Cooper, who was... I wasn't just me who did that New York Times story. I mean, without Helene, it wouldn't have happened. She was a New York Times staff reporter who worked with us. And so we had an interview with her in episode one, which was really amazing because she never goes on camera. We also got, I think, a really good interview with Alex Dietrich, which she kind of was on camera with us more than she might have been before. And then Derek Pitts was another favorite part of my favorite part of that thing, of our series. He's the African-American astronomer from Pittsburgh who was supposed to speak today, and he couldn't make it because he got COVID. But I absolutely loved the way he contributed this sort of broader scientific perspective to the series. But I think the point about that series that I want to make is it was really geared towards people in a mass audience who don't know anything about this topic. So we weren't really looking to like do a whole lot of new stuff for the UFO community. It was really about reaching an audience that doesn't know any of the stuff that all of us consider not to be new. And that was the whole goal. And it was originally going to be for CNN. So if it had been on CNN, I think it would have reached a bigger audience than we got on Hulu, but CNN had some problems and they just couldn't, you know, I won't go into all the details of it. It wasn't anything to do with our project, but it was things that went on in the company and they just weren't airing any documentaries. So yeah, I think that's the main thing. My goal ever since I started this work has always been to try to reach the audience outside of the UFO community, because that's really where change needs to happen. And that's who we, you know, that's if we're going to create a societal change, we need to reach the broader public. So that was the purpose of that series. Yeah.
Great. James.
I wanted to first and foremost take a moment to thank James and Jay for putting this event on. Thank you guys. Yeah. Yeah. And then I wanted to quickly count some hands out there. How many people out there want to know where the bodies are? One, two, three, four, everybody. All right, I'll suffice to say, I'm right there with you. Honestly, I never thought that I would make a documentary on an alleged UFO crash and live aliens reportedly walking through the town. I mean, when I heard about that case in the late 90s, I dismissed it as about as quickly as you can say howdy doody. I don't know how many people out there can say howdy doody. Howdy doody, okay? That quick. I'm serious. In fact, I gave a special thanks credit to this guy named Tim Coleman. We co-produced Out of the Blue together. And Tim's like, bloody well, mate, I told you about that case back in 1999 and you didn't believe me. I said, yep, you're right, I didn't believe you. And you refused to look into it. Yep, I refused to look into it. So I would have to say the climate has changed so much that I felt, even though I was pushing my own comfort level a little bit, I felt that I could make a film like Moment of Contact on an alleged UFO crash and live aliens being reportedly captured and ultimately flown back to the United States. And now you're looking at legislation that was recently passed that talks about whistleblower protection and crashed debris and things that I just never thought I would see in my lifetime happening today. So it's a very exciting time. And like the previous gentleman said, you can't put the genie back in the bottle, right?
Can I add one thing,
please,
to that?
Please.
That I think that this year, actually, there was another film, and Randall Nickerson is here in our audience, who made the film Aerial Phenomenon. Stand up, Randy. Stand up. And the fact that we had two films come out, both of them involving, you know, aliens, people encountering aliens alive or dead, but aliens, and that the films were really widely well received, and nobody's jumping around saying it's all hoaxed or whatever. You know, it was a very important development that these films came out, I think, recently.
So we talk about destigmatization often. What is it for? So we want to destigmatize this conversation, this topic. For what purpose? What is it toward?
Well, I think that this is just my personal perspective on it. You know, they changed the word UFO, UAP, right? So already UFO had baggage. You mentioned UFO, it provokes immediately the giggle factor. So to create an environment where people like Ryan Graves feels comfortable to come forward and talk about and address the issue. And so that changing climate encourages more and more people to come through. So I think it's very important, very significant to rebrand, I guess, the old UFO phenomenon into something what we're dealing with today. And that encourages more people to come forward, more credible people, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think a lot of it is for the witnesses themselves, for the people who have had these encounters, and some of them traumatized by it. I mean, it has a profound effect, no matter what that effect is. And for them to be stigmatized, I almost think of it as a human rights violation, especially when it's by their own government, to be told not to talk about it, right? And then there's all the experiencers who are just regular people. And I think if there's a level of it that to me is like a human rights issue for these individual people. But I also think we need to diminish it, because if we're going to have what everyone wants, which is official disclosure, we want to let the world know that this is real, you have to overcome the stigma for that to actually be able to happen. So, yeah.
I was going to add on what Leslie just said, because I don't know how many of you out there has actually thought about, you know, I know the word disclosure also has baggage, but let's just say that in an alternate reality, the government decided to come clean and disclose the truth or what they know about the phenomenon, right? And this is something that I've been recently addressing in a new project that I'm working on. I never really thought about the complexities of disclosure, right? Let's just say that they decided to make a statement to the world or to the United States. Who does that? It's not going to be Sean Kirkpatrick running Arrow, right? He's going to look at the data and make his determination and probably give a classified briefing to somebody, and send it intel or whatever. You know, the president, it's not the job of the Congress. It's not their job to disclose the fact that, you know, there might be a certain percentage of these UAP or UFOs that originate from a non-human intelligence. So, and the president's polarizing, no matter who the president is, it's half the country doesn't like, hates them, right? So it's not the president's job. So would it go to the United Nations? But these are something that I've, for the first time, I'm actually asking some representatives, like, is there a plan? Like, what are we doing here? What happens if they do realize? And of course, I'm sure for the most part, they know we're not dealing with something. I mean, look, there's a conventional explanation for the vast majority of, you know, weather balloons and misidentified aircraft. We all know that. But at the core, 10 or 15%, those are what's of interest to us. And that ultimately, in my opinion, and I believe in the opinion of many other government officials right now today, represent or originate from a non-human intelligence. And what's the plan? How do we get that information out to the public? I mean, just the actual execution of it. You know what I mean? It's a kind of a conundrum. I don't see how they can do it. Leslie?
I mean, it may not be entirely up to us.
Right.
The phenomenon itself plays a role, and it may be the determining factor as to whether any kind of official announcement is made, because maybe something will happen that will precipitate it. But I've never heard of it, there being any plan in place. Yeah. No one's ever told me this is how it's going to happen, be this person. I think it depends on what precipitates that moment, if it ever happens. You know, is it going to be a whistleblower that's going to say, bring it out? Is it going to be an event that happens? I mean, what actually happens is going to help determine how it's presented and who presents it.
What's meant by that the phenomenon has some control over disclosure?
You always ask the tough questions.
Hover over the Macy's Day Parade and it's game over.
I mean, it's a really big question. I mean, if we're talking about something with intelligence, right? We're talking about some kind of phenomenon that's operating in on our planet and above our planet and under the water, and there's a presence here. And so they're intelligent. They seem to be deciding how they're going to interact with us humans and to what extent they're going to interact and how much impact they're going to have on events in our society. I mean, I think all of that is, they're monitoring us. And so they're not like just something floating around up there. I mean, they obviously have capabilities to make decisions and choices. I mean, I know that sounds kind of far out, but I think it's true.
Does that mean for the people who think that the phenomenon is benevolent, that then there's a good reason why we don't know?
There's a good, you mean we
so
don't
if,
know what?
Let's yeah. imagine that the predominant factor around disclosure is whether or not the phenomenon wants it to occur. Okay, and let's say the phenomenon is benevolent. Then that means that there's some good reason why we don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I would say the phenomenon's benevolent or not benevolent. I would just say it's there and it's been here for a long time and it's connected to our planet and it appreciates our planet. I don't know how much it appreciates us and the way we're behaving in our planet right now and in the direction we're going. But I mean, so I don't know. I think of it as a more neutral kind of presence as opposed to benevolent or not benevolent. So I don't know if that would really determine what's going to happen, is that kind of a question. I don't know what James would say, but...
Well, I remember coming to the conclusion, and my conclusions are changing hourly.
Yeah, right.
But I remember thinking a pretty good match, certainly to a lot of the witnesses I talked to, that there's this omnipresent intelligence that has the ability to manifest itself in a multitude of ways. Like it could appear as nuts and bolts. I think about the case, the landing case in Socorro, New Mexico, with Officer Lonnie Zamora in 1964. It left impressions in the ground. There were footprints and burn marks and things of that nature. Clearly a device that would be nuts and bolts. It was seen up close and left all this trace evidence on the ground. But then you hear other cases where there's this like psychic connection to witnesses that are really credible, like military people, like predicting what a move we're going to do. You know, I think about General Parviz Jafari, where he has this incredible encounter in the mid-1970s over Tehran, Iran. And he's like basically feeling threatened by this thing and decides that his only action is to shoot it. So he just goes to like shoot this thing. And then moments before he's going to pull the trigger, his whole thing freezes up. Like the thing had control and read his thoughts, you know? This coming from a fighter pilot. So that's the one. But then I think, well, maybe it's all of the above. Maybe it's such a vast space. Maybe we're having periodic interplanetary visitation. Maybe it's time travelers. Maybe it's interdimensional. Maybe, you know what I mean? So, obviously I don't know. This is all speculation, but we could be dealing with all of the above, right?
Yeah, I don't think we know.
Yeah, heck, of course not. I certainly don't.
All right, would it be a good time to open it up to the audience that's over here? Is that all right?
Sure, yeah, we can definitely do that. I have one question about moment of contact regarding the soldier that died. It's inferred in the film that he died as a result of being scratched or handled by the ET. But he also interacted with Americans, or it was inferred that he interacted with Americans.
I am unaware. I know that there was American involvement. I heard that time and time again, both from civilian witnesses and military witnesses. But in terms of, he's obviously deceased, and his only other witness would have been Eric Lopes, who threatened to kill us when we went to his house. So honestly, I don't know if he had, and we certainly didn't allude to that in the movie, I don't know if he had any interaction with the Americans. That part, I just don't know. He could have, but I have no idea.
All right. Because that's what was tickling my brain. It seemed like if they had a certain isotope of polonium that would wreck your immune system, then you might die because you're full of very common background bacteria.
You know, one thing that we did, we got a little criticized when we did the kind of ambush to this guy's house, but I say that every other option had been exhausted for 26 years. So the only remaining option was to go to this house and doorstep the guy. And one of the things that we did was we spoke to, well, this is something that most people don't know about with this case, which is crazy. So Eric Lopes is married to Marco Cherisi's sister. So Marco Cherisi is the military police officer who allegedly captured this creature with his bare hands and then got this infection. And Leslie can tell you a lot more about that because she's been really doing some great research on this. She had the autopsy report translated. She's been in touch with the doctors. It's an ongoing thing, which I'd love you to talk about. So we contacted the wife of of Eric Lopes, and we said, what is it going to take to get your husband to come forward? And she said, bring my brother back to life, and then Eric will talk with you.
We'll be right back after this quick break.
Hi, Kurt. Hi, Leslie. Hi, James. I'm a big fan of all your work. I was curious to ask either Leslie or James if you'd investigated Dr. Roger Lear in your investigation into the Virginia case, specifically his work with doctors, surgeons, things of that nature.
So frustrating, you guys. This is one of my biggest regrets in life. No, I'm kidding. But it is one of my biggest regrets in making this film is that in 2013, Roger Lear found out that I'd been in, doing work on the Virginia case. And I was shooting in Los Angeles, and we had all these people coming in from different corners of the world. And at the time, we had kind of a laser-like focus on Rua, but we had also interviewed the daughter of the first man who coined the phrase flying saucer, Kenneth Arnold's daughter. So we were really busy, Kim, doing all this stuff. And Dr. Roger Lear contacts me. He's like, you got to get me. I need to come. You know, you're doing something on Virginia. I need to come and interview you. What he didn't tell me was, I'd bend over backwards trying to accommodate it, was that he was dying of cancer and that there were very critical aspects of his investigation of Virginia that he needed to convey to me on camera, at which point I would have dropped everything. But I kept kind of postponing it. And he said, okay, well, if you're not going to interview me, at least I'm going to send you my tapes. So he sent me all the raw tapes of him there. And we went through those tapes. And I also bought his book, and I was reading his book. And the tapes are pretty much a transcript. The book is a transcript from the taped interviews that he did, except there's one in particular where he goes with Ubedajara Rodriguez, who's one of the leading investigators, also a prominent lawyer in the town of Virginia, and Ubedajara Rodriguez's son. And they meet with two doctors at Humanitas Hospital, and Roger's with another guy. And in the book, and like I said, the book is a direct transcript basically of the interviews because I have the taped interviews, so I could see it's all accurate, it's all there, except the only thing I don't have are the taped interviews with the Humanitas Hospital two doctors that they met with, in which they said there was telepathic communication with the entity in the hospital. And I reached out to the gentleman that was with Roger Lear at the time. And he had since passed. I just missed him. Obviously, Roger Lear was no longer alive. So the only testimony I could get my hands on was in the book. So I didn't put it in the movie. But what was said was in his book, and I've talked to people that know Roger Lear, is that there was communication that the beings basically said that they felt sad for us as a race, that we were unaware of the powers that we had, that we were much more powerful creatures than was reflecting in our civilization, I guess. But I would love Leslie to talk about what she's been, if you wouldn't mind. I don't want to push the envelope here. So if I'm going to say something that's going to make you uncomfortable, you tell me. Because she reached into some deep people that deep in her back pocket that made some confirmations for her that I don't, without revealing names, perhaps you could share that. Because it was a really nice validation for me.
Definitely. I mean, after his movie came out, you know, I did speak to a number of people, you know, with high clearances or been in this issue for years and years and years, some of the insiders that I consult with. And basically they verify that this happened. It's a movie like that comes out, you could see all kinds of people reacting and saying, what are you, crazy? Something, creatures? You know, no, it's the opposite. These insiders were confirming this. So that was really exciting, really exciting. And it was great for James to hear it. And the fact that there was U.S. involvement and most likely debris and even bodies from that case reside now in the United States. I'm not able to find out where. I can't get that information, but never give up. And I also wanted to say about the medical, I mean, I was able to talk to this doctor in Brazil the doctor of Charizzi when he was in the hospital. And so he knew a lot about what caused his death. And the autopsy report was really interesting because of the nature of the microorganisms that were found on him, which have all kinds of suggestive components of coming from some kind of a non-human creature. And I still have to do more work on that, but it's very evidential. And this elderly doctor who's like famous for doing autopsies in Brazil, he's written books on it, you know, referred in our interview to the, the man that he grabbed the ET. And then, of course, later in the interview, I said, well, what caused his death? And he says, he tries to hedge around it. But during the conversation, he referenced that. I don't think there's any question that that's what killed that person. He described the little scratch on his body and how the organisms that infected him went into through that cut. And there was a cut on his up around his neck when he grabbed it. So anyway, I also spoke with his sister, who's James interviewed in the film, and she also, it was really moving to talk to her. What she's been through has just been unbelievable. The fear that these people live with, the intimidation that has gone on in their lives about speaking about this is just, you think people are under pressure here. It's like nothing compared to what those people have gone through. So yeah, I mean, I really commend James for his work on this case because it's so important. This case is so important. It has so much potential. And he's getting closer and closer every day to finding more. Yeah.
You know, I need to be more measured, and I need to think about what I'm about to say before I open my fat mouth sometimes. And it's something that I'm working on. I'm just like, I can't help myself sometimes, right? But I'm shooting myself in the foot. So I got to like really be mindful of that. And so I can confirm that, you know, the investigation is ongoing. We are hot on the trail. And that just because you've located something, it doesn't necessarily mean you can get your hands on it, right? So there's negotiations that are happening, and I will never stop. So... yeah.
Leslie, I believe it was you who mentioned Politico was working on a similar story to the New York Times story in 2017. Who made you aware of that? What was the difference with their story? And did they ever report anything?
We were aware of it. I don't remember how far back we were aware of it, but we became aware of it just because some of the sources we worked with, Politico had approached them also. And we just had enough of a network of people to know what Politico was up to. And they did come out with something, actually. And here's what happened. We knew they were working on a story, but they didn't have what we had. There was no way their story could compete with ours. But nonetheless, we wanted to be first because when you're first, you're breaking the story, right? I mean, they knew about ATIP, but they didn't have Harry Reid. They didn't have other stuff that we had. So the day that our piece was going to go out on the New York Times, it was actually Lou who called us. He was driving, and we were just waiting for them to put the piece out. They were like messing with the headline or something. And he said that Politico's just about to release their story. You know, like they just called me. They're just about to do it. And Helene Cooper was going nuts. She described this in the series that we were referring to earlier. She was just like, hurry up and get it out there, because it was literally a race at that moment. And we released our story, but I think it was within a couple of minutes that theirs came out, literally. It was within minutes of when ours came out. And ours was already, as soon as it was out, it was like in the news bulletins everywhere. I mean, it was so fast. But if Politico had gone out first, it just would have messed it up, even though our story was way better. So, I mean, we just had more, you know. So you're absolutely correct. They did do a story. And you can go, it's online. I mean, often when people talk about this story having broken in 2017, they will say by the New York Times and Politico, because they did do their own story, so.
My question is about disclosure in general. It's always kind of thought of as a federal issue for good reasons. I live out in New Jersey. There are a lot of sightings on the books out there. What are your thoughts about pursuing state-level disclosure?
I mean, I guess MUFON is trying to do that, right? They have like these state representatives that, I don't know. You'd have to say more about what you would envision, how you'd envision that happening.
I was just thinking that the New Jersey State Police, for example, must have loads of data and reports from over the years, and I just don't ever hear about this happening at a non-federal level.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really good point, I think. I bet the police departments all over the country have a lot of information. You're absolutely right. It would be an interesting project for somebody to take on, to go to all the police departments and see what they could get. Yeah, it's a great idea.
One question that came up earlier was, James, you've been talking about traveling to D.C. for some filming someone recently. There's been a lot of talk about potential upcoming hearings, and there's also been a lot of talk about testimony happening privately that might be made public at some point in the near future. Is there anything you can talk about with regard to the likelihood of either of those things?
I can neither confirm nor deny. It was a very, very exciting trip. I remember getting back from D.C., back to Vermont, little sleepy Vermont, and people, hey, you know, how did it go in D.C.? I'm like, you know, I think I'm just going to go ahead and not, you know, because it is like I went from an X-Files existence to, you know what I mean? Like, is this really happening? So there's a lot of incredible things going on, and there's some concern as to whether or not their testimony is going to actually get out to the general public. Will it go into this sort of, you know, one-way door into Arrow or into the intelligence communities and then never see its way out? So I think there's some preventative measures that they're considering taking place to prevent that from ultimately happening.
And in terms of a hearing, I mean, Tim Burchett has talked about wanting to do a hearing, and he tends to have a hearing. So that's what I think he has said that publicly, but it's not surprising, I'm sure, to anybody. He's really on fire about this. So there may be something coming up that he's going to make happen.
You know, there's language. I wish I wanted to have it with me, you guys, in the recent UAP legislation that was crafted by, I think, Senator Gillibrand and Rubio and Gallego and Gallagher, where they specifically talk about recovered debris and encouraging people that were involved, whether it was like directly with the government or perhaps it was when the government pays a subcontractor to do it. Yeah, subcontractor. And I brought that up with interview with Representative Andre Carson, who was instrumental in putting on the hearings last year. And I thought, well, this is a safe bet to ask him about potential rumors of rumblings of recovered debris. Like, this language speaks for itself. It's right here in the UAP legislation that was signed into law. And I thought, well, that would be a pretty safe way of asking him, hey, do we have any crashed UFOs? You know what I mean? And it was like the first time I got the real politician like talk about, you know, the weather. I'm like, well, hang on a second. I just asked you about this. And then so let me try another angle. How about if I go at it from Senator Harry Reid? You know, then it's like, oh, the trees are blossoming early this year. So I was like, okay, so you don't want to talk about that. But it's in the legislation and it is being addressed. So that's really exciting.
James previously mentioned that he had a discussion with Robert Bigelow, who informed him that, quote unquote, they are present and walking among us. Could James provide further details regarding the content of that conversation?
Yeah, so Mr. Bigelow never said not to say anything. It was open conversation. I had a film out, which I worked on with Leslie, about an event we did at the National Press Club in 2007. And I made a movie about it called I Know What I Saw. And after the movie came out, it was a two-hour presentation on the History Channel. I got an email from Robert Bigelow's secretary. She said, Mr. Bigelow wanted me to reach out to you, sir, on a job well done for he watched your film on I Know What I Saw. And we went back and forth a little bit. I was like, whoa, Robert Bigelow. And long story short, he's like, hey, let's get together for dinner or late lunch or something. So I went to his house in Las Vegas, probably 2009, maybe 2010, something like that. And he starts talking about, you know, he wants to know what my next move is and stuff. And he's kind of feeling me out a little bit. And he's also like talking about the potential impact. He's like, yeah, we've done, I don't know if he said studies or we've had, you know, some very, you know, the intellectual heavyweights on the, it's part of our intellectual think tank, NIDS or BASS, look into the impact this story might possibly have on the world. And he said, you know, take Iran-Contra and President Clinton and all the scandals you've ever heard and multiply that. I don't know if he said 1,000 or 1,000,000. That would be like the economy and organized religion and financial institutions. And I remember thinking, I don't really know if I agree with that. Maybe I'm wrong, but that's what he said, they're walking among us. I said, what do you mean they're walking among us? He said, they're walking among us. And I'm not saying I believe that, but that's what he told me. And of course, I've learned since then. I mean, he was working with Senator Reid at the time, right? And he'd already had an earlier version of ATIP, which would have been OSAP, I guess, up and running. And so, you know, he's had the government contracts. He's got, I don't know. Either he's crazy or he knows something that we don't, or I don't.
He said the same thing on 60 Minutes.
Yeah, he didn't tell me not to say anything about it. He never said, hey, I'm going to share something with you, don't. He didn't, none of that. So, yeah.
And others have said the same thing, too.
Yeah, I don't necessarily, you know, for me, it would be seeing as believing. And of course, even if I saw something like that, I probably still wouldn't talk about it because, you know, that's kind of, so anyway, that's what he said. So I hope that clears.
If you saw one of them, you wouldn't know that it was one of them.
And if I did, I still wouldn't want to tell that. How to quickly diminish what little credibility I have left.
Over the last few years that you've delved into UAP-related phenomena, what's the most surprising connection between what you knew before and what you know now?
The most surprising connection between what I knew before and what I know now? Is there? Can you ask him to rephrase?
Please. He may be trying to say, like, what's been the most surprising thing about, like, when you started off, you didn't know about this phenomenon. You've since learned a lot.
Yeah, I didn't.
So,
know
what's been most surprising or interesting to you along the way?
I didn't know anything. I didn't know who Lou was. I was like, Lou, who's Lou, and who's Howl? Who's a Howl? Or am I kept Howl saying the put off? Okay. And Element 115, what I knew vaguely about. Barely know about what CE5 is. I have a question for you both about that, by the way. So, what's been surprising? Jeez.
Has it changed your worldview?
Yeah. It's not pleasant. Yeah, it doesn't make me comfortable. I get extremely nervous thinking about this subject. I don't like to interview people on this subject. I don't like to talk about it. I don't think people, even when people raise their hands, they said, I would want to know where the bodies are. I would want to know. Do you? Like, would you? Like, think about that. No, because that's what I thought as well. But I think if you haven't thought about how can it be that what you pursue can have some deleterious outcome? If you haven't thought about what could the answer be such that I would scream and beg to not know the answer, then you shouldn't be exploring it. Yeah, I find almost all of it surprising. I find it plenty of it contradictory. So then it's difficult to know what should be believed. Well, that's my answer. So about CE5. Can you explain what it is to the audience, to the live audience as well, and is it effective in your opinion?
It's a new Mazda hatchback, I think, isn't it? It's got a fuel injection, 2.4 liter, four-cylinder motor. It's pretty fast. No, I'm kidding, sorry. No, Leslie, please.
No, it's just kind of a strange question. I mean, I have a note. You mean what, the CE5 being when you bring them in yourself, like what Stephen Greer does? I have had no experience with that, zero, so I can't comment on it.
I do actually have to say, in a rather serious note, that I do believe that consciousness is all connected. So if they're out there, theoretically, that, you know, the web of consciousness, you should be able to communicate, right? I mean, I know that was something that Edgar Mitchell would talk about, what this epiphany he had in space, that he felt this profound sense of interconnectedness with the molecules of the spaceship to the stars and everything out there. So in principle, it would make sense that if there is this interconnected web of intelligence, that you could theoretically, right, possibly communicate with it just by thinking about it. But I have zero experience in even trying to do that. I don't even meditate. I mean, come on.
Would you recommend it?
Meditating?
Would you recommend CE5?
Gosh,
the little of it that you know about.
Well, if you did it and then you talked about it, you better have some very compelling evidence because otherwise you're just going to completely discredit yourself. I mean, hey, I've got the ability to bring in aliens in spaceships. Oh, really? What kind of evidence do you have? I got a couple little blurry lights walking around. You know, I'm just saying, you know.
Part about that is that there's several witnesses that earlier you talked about, hey, we need them to come forward, and they may also have little evidence. So you can't say to anyone, if you don't have much evidence, don't come forward, or you better have evidence.
If you're making contact with aliens, allegedly, then I think that you should, if you're going to present that to the world, you should have some compelling evidence that is going on. I'm not saying it's not happening or this happening. I just know nothing, very little about it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
We're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back.
This is a question for all three of you. We've heard from many people to try to remain neutral on what we think of as the nature of the phenomenon and what it represents to humanity. Whether it's nuts and bolts, something psychic, a breakaway civilization, a control system, a psyop, what have you. Since you all started studying this, researching and investigating phenomena, how have your own views changed throughout that process, and what were some of the watershed moments that changed your perspective?
I mean, when I started reporting on UFOs, my first story on UFOs was in the year 2000, so it was like 23 years ago. And when I first started on this, I think what's really changed for me is I had this very sort of simplistic approach that the extraterrestrial hypothesis was the explanation, basically. That these, I mean, that's what everybody was saying in those earlier years. I mean, I'm talking about, you know, officials that I interviewed around the world and stuff like that. The Cometa report, which first got me started in this, their conclusion was the extraterrestrial hypothesis is the most valid one. So it was like this concept that we were being visited from some other solar system or some other galaxy, that they were travelers coming in ships, right? And I've since learned, of course, like all of us have, I think, who have been around this for a long time, that it's way, way more complicated than that. And here we are today looking at all kinds of anomalies that seem to be all interconnected and that all relate to the UFO phenomenon. So it's, for me, it's been more about expanding my perception of the complexity and multi-dimensional level and consciousness aspect of what a UFO actually is. Yeah, and I think Jacques Vallée, of course, was doing that decades before a lot of us were. I mean, he was sort of ahead of the curve, and earlier a lot of people didn't like what he was saying, but it's turned out to be the way it's viewed now much more. So yeah, I would say that was really the big change for me in how I see the phenomenon itself. And it's only getting more and more complex the more I learn about it.
Do you have any thoughts on what Lou Elizondo meant when he said we would be somber if we knew what he knew?
He meant to say sober. I can't help myself. I'm sorry. I'm of the belief that regardless if it's the truth, if it's what's happening, if we're just part of this much bigger plan, or I don't care if it's a little scary. I'm ready. I'm already, you know, it's whether it's scary or not, it's not going to change anything. It's still there, right? So I don't agree with, like, oh, well, let's keep it from the general public because it's scary. Or, you know what I mean? Like, if it's part of the bigger picture, I want to know about it. And, yeah, that's what I think.
I mean, what did he mean by somber? I think he meant that he's privy to a lot of classified information, right? And it's sort of along the lines of what you were saying. I mean, there's, I don't know if the word is dark that I want to use, but there's a side to this phenomenon which is frightening, and it's probably way more powerful than we have been told. And, you know, there's this something that has that kind of power over the human race. And there's a lot that the national security establishment knows that we don't know. So to me, it makes complete sense that the term somber to describe what that knowledge probably is really resonates with me as being true. But I agree with James. It doesn't mean we necessarily want to keep it secret, but I suspect that it is that way. And you were sort of alluding to that and how it was affecting you, right?
I'll be a bit personal. I'll see how I can say this. I have an open mind, and it's too open And I used to think of that as some virtue. And now I see it as there's a defect, just as there's such a thing as being too closed. There is such a thing as being too open. And I would hear people say, don't be so open that your head falls out. And then I would think, yeah, you're just trying to justify your closed-mindedness. Like, I'm going to take every position as equally true. There's this quote from H.P. Lovecraft, which talks about the case for nescience, for ignorance, and how the heinous aspects of an open mind haven't been explicated by intellectuals, especially by intellectuals. And it goes like, one of the most merciful aspects of this world is the inability of the human mind to correlate its contents. And that as soon as we do, this unfettered scientific investigation may open up such terrifying vistas of reality and our frightful position therein, that we may beg for the peace and safety of the darkness, or flee from the light into the peace and safety of the darkness, something like that. Anyhow, I think that some people don't think about it seriously enough, and maybe serious is the issue, but I think about it super seriously, like extremely seriously. Too much, like way too much. Jeez.
This question is for Kurt. I wanted to ask, because Gary Nolan spoke to us recently about coming forward in a scientific way, and since you're so scientifically minded, what do you recommend to the UFO community about presenting evidence in an effective way for people like yourself and other people who are scientifically minded?
So science, by its nature, depends on replicability, which means you need to be able to verify it, so show it to other scientists, and also reproduce it. And these anecdotes are not reproducible, but that doesn't mean that they should be discounted. For instance, there are anecdotes about medical effects, and you take them into account, you get doctors to pass it up the chain, and you take that into account into your analysis. So I don't know how to do that. I don't know how that could work for this sort of topic. But I am interested in developing. I'm extremely curious about where science headed. So think about science had developed from not science to the science that we have now, like science 1.0. And I think about, well, there are certain isolated cases, you can't make sense of that. There are outliers, you can't make sense of that because you discard them in your data. And then there's also the experiential aspect. So I'm thinking, well, science hasn't, it's strange to say this, but science hasn't finished. So there's science 1.0, but I'm curious as to what is science 2.0. I call that abhijh gnosis. Gnosis is a Western term for knowledge, and abhijna is a Eastern term for knowledge, which has a spiritual connotation to it. Anyhow, I don't know. I don't know that answer. I also think that disclosure, when people say we want disclosure, I think that it doesn't mean that the government tells you, because if they say they have a body, you would just be skeptical and say, show me. Even if they say I don't have a body, you would say, well, prove it. So it has to come down to the scientific community, that somehow the government has to give data to scientists. And then that also needs to be translated to the public, or the public wouldn't understand what the scientists are talking about.
What about witness testimony? We've had thousands of witnesses come out and who've risked everything. How does testimony become evidence?
Yeah, that's tricky, because the court of law doesn't have the same standard as science or some subfields of science. So for instance, in the court of law, I'm not even quite sure about this because I don't know how it works. I don't know what's the criteria for it to be solely witness testimony that makes someone convicted. I don't know. And under what crimes, I don't know. But in physics, for instance, there's something called Six Sigma, which means P value of 0.05, which means there's a 5% chance that what you're seeing is by some random fluctuation. And if there's some pill that gives you a P of 0.05, it's a great pill. In physics, that's a poor, poor pill. You want 0.000005. I may have one plus or minus one zero. Anyhow, so I don't know, how the heck does witness testimonial fit into that? I'm not the representative of science. I don't know.
How dare you contradict us?
Yeah. No, but
I mean, it's got to expand. I think what you're saying is there's a witness pool that he works with, and there's certain criteria that that pool has to have. And same with the medical studies that are being done by Kit Green and Gary. But you're saying that it needs to expand to include more people.
So,
and that's a valid point to make, I think.
What I said earlier about the H.P. Lovecraft quote and going into the peace and safety, it rings it reminds people of Plato's cave. And then people like to say, oh, look at me, I'm going to go out of the cave. Like, you silly, poor, illusioned people. And I want to be the enlightened one, literally enlightened. Yeah, okay, so I don't think you should be enlightened, and I don't think you are enlightened. Well, anyway, that's just an aside. The point is that in that story, and I was speaking to Diana Pasolka about this, the people then, the next part of the story is you go back into the cave, and then you tell people about it, and then afterwards, Sangha, she brings up this word Sangha, which means community. Community is a necessary component, and if you don't have that, you become blinded by the light. You become blinded. The light is not good for you. Unless you have a community of people who share your goals, and somehow love is integral to that. Love, which is this woo word now, love. So when Lou said at one point, hey, what should people do? And Lou said, you should go home and hug your family and hug your children. People are like, what the heck is that? Like, I'm asking you about Roswell and you tell me to hug my child. But there is something that's true about that. We think of truth as something, propositions that can be held, but there are also actions that can be lived. And so it's not like, oh, I want Plato's cave for the propositions. Yeah, but also live it.
I have, last thing. I just wanted to say we have a couple of representatives from the ranch coming on soon here. If you guys brought any hitchhikers, don't anybody pick up any hitchhikers today, okay? Thank you. Just say no.
I just want to say too.
Yeah. No. Okay. And thank you to Leslie. Extra applause for Leslie. Extra applause for James.